You're listening to Vatican Radio.
In a world where conflict affects so many communities, it is important to recognize the connection between food insecurity and social unrest. Kimberly Flowers, director of the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, was brought to Rome by a United States mission to the United Nations as a keynote speaker at the Food and Agriculture Organization's 13th annual George McGovern Lecture. She highlighted the connection between conflict areas and food insecurity in her speech entitled Examining Linkages, the Nexus Between Food Insecurity and Political Instability. The Center for Strategic and International Studies is a Washington, D.C.-based bipartisan foreign affairs think tank. Leading the field in defense and intelligence thinking, they also provide recommendations to policymakers on how to develop foreign assistance programs that are focused on ending hunger and poverty. Kimberly Flowers spoke with Vatican Radio's Linda Bordoni about food insecurity and how it is both a cause and consequence of conflict, often sparking violence and civil unrest.
I was delivering the 13th annual George McGovern Lecture yesterday at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, and the title of my speech was Examining Linkages, Looking at the Nexus Between Food Insecurity and Political Instability. So we had probably around 200 people there, a mixture of FAO staff and member representatives, as well as a lot of students and people who work in this area, and gave about a 30-minute address and answered questions as well. The main point was talking about how food insecurity is both a cause and consequence of conflict, and looking at how food prices soar, for example, how people in urban areas, how it can spark unrest and violence, but also looking at how food aid can be weaponized and used as a weapon of war that we see a lot. Talking as well about fragile states and how that might impede or help or make it more difficult for us to reach the sustainable development goals of ending hunger. I touched upon four different countries that I gave some kind of deeper statistics or talked about more specifically in my speech yesterday, and that was Syria, of course, as well as South Sudan, Nigeria, and Venezuela. All have slightly different stories of how the lack of food and relates to lack of stability, but all very good examples for us to look at. I also often talk in other speeches about Yemen, but I think all of those are really good examples of how frequent and intense shocks that vulnerable populations have or that they're going through, how that affects political stability and violence.
I think it's good you speak about Yemen. It really is a forgotten conflict, as is South Sudan. You know, everybody knows about Syria, and it's tragic, and we're following day by day, but there are many other countries in the world that deserve our attention.
Absolutely. I mean, in Yemen, 40% of the population was food insecure almost before the conflict. Oh. When you add in the issues of water scarcity, such as in Yemen, it really compounds the issues there.
We are at the beginning of a new U.S. government. You were saying before that you provide recommendations as regarding funding for projects. What do you hope may come out of this new administration, and maybe what do you fear?
Question on everybody's mind. It's certainly come up frequently in all of my meetings in the last few days. I'll say a couple of things. I mean, one thing that's really important to note is the role of the U.S. government under the Obama administration, how much the government has sort of stepped up in terms of funding and attention towards long-term agriculture development and nutrition programs. And so President Obama started something called Feed the Future. It's the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative that was launched in response to the food price crisis of 07 and 08. It was launched as part of the L'Aquila Food Security Initiative at the 2009 G8 summit here in Italy. And through that, the U.S. government has invested $6.6 billion over the last several years in 19 focus countries, again, on long-term agricultural development programs to reduce poverty and reduce stunting. And the reason I start there is because that relates to what happened this summer in the U.S. The U.S. Congress really sees global food security as a bipartisan an issue. For U.S. Congress, who controls the purse strings and the money, this isn't a Democrat or a Republican thing. There was huge bipartisan consensus to pass what is called the Global Food Security Act of 2016. And as part of that act, it codified Feed the Future to continue for the next 2 years. And that's really a critical and profound statement, not only of how the U.S. government sees global food security as an important foreign assistance tool, but it bridges from one administration to the next. So what that means is food security is law for at least the next 2 years. So no matter who the next president comes in, that will continue at $1 billion a year. And again, this is not food aid. This is looking at long-term international development programs. In regards to President-elect Trump, it was certainly a stunning election that we were not expecting in our world in Washington, D.C., in the policy space. A couple of things that I think are important, and one is that it's too soon to tell. It's too soon to say what his or his administration's stance is really going to be in terms of both foreign assistance and global food security. I think it's important to remember that President Bush, when he was elected, didn't see Africa as a strategic partner, didn't really understand foreign assistance. He became a wonderful development leader. I'm hoping that the same happens with Trump, that his administration, who may or may not know a lot about this issue, that we can help inform them of why it's important. And that includes tying it back to national security, which we know is important to them and can be done with food security, or tying it back to economic growth and why this is important. Sure, I have some fears. I have fears that a few years down the line, foreign assistance funding may get cut some. I have fears that he may place people in positions that may or may not understand climate change as well. But we've also seen him already come back on some of the rhetoric he used in his campaign and reverse some of that language. So let's wait and see what really we have in store for us as the U.S. government. My hope is that we continue to be a world leader and we continue to invest in this because it's important for our security, but as well as for the rights of those around the world.
You mentioned climate change, which is obviously the defining issue, perhaps, mm-hmm. at the moment in your field of work. Mm-hmm. How are policies fitting this new world scenario that we are tackling?
Well, I should say I'm not a climate change expert. I should throw that out there first. I travel all around the world in my research as I look at foreign assistance programs. And everywhere I go, smallholders always talk to me about how the rainy seasons change, about how there's increased droughts, increased floods. You know, we see that across the board. And unfortunately, you know, even though a lot of the climate change that is human-induced on the western side of the world, it's affecting more of the developing countries and particularly smallholder farmers. So agriculture is a sector that feels the impact of climate change more than most, and that's a really important thing to consider. It's very clear to me why climate change is happening and what we need to do to mitigate. There's a lot of climate smart agriculture that are techniques that are being used anyway, as far as and encouraged through development programs, of what we can do to better mitigate and respond and adapt to climate change issues. A lot of it goes back to quality inputs like seeds and fertilizers and making sure that we have the private sector engaged and we're using new technologies so that we can continue to produce the amount we need to produce, even when soaring temperatures may increase pests and disease. So there's a lot of different elements to this, from education to technology to engagement. A lot of it goes back to education, making sure that political leaders around the world, not just in the U.S., mm-hmm. understand what climate change means and understand the implications of it and how climate change, even if American farmers aren't feeling it quite the same because of the technologies that they have and the advances, how it might affect smallholders in other areas and change the amount we can produce and what that means for global and food insecurity.
You were saying you've spent a lot of time in Africa. You know firsthand what it means to be a smallholder mm-hmm. farmer right. in Ethiopia or, mm-hmm. or in Botswana. Mm. How has that affected your work today?
I think many people in the world don't understand, and it's quite an oxymoron to think about it, but that many of those that are the most hungry in the world are smallholder farmers. That there's this lean season, that there's hidden hunger, that it is so dependent upon weather cycles and other issues. Many smallholder farmers don't have the literacy or education levels that are needed to really better understand how simple good agricultural practice can make a big difference in not only their increase in production, but most importantly, increase in their income, because that's what really is going to sustain their practices. I worked for a company called FinTrack before I worked at CSIS, and that company works on agricultural solutions to end hunger and poverty. And one thing I really learned there, even more so than my time at USAID living in the field, was how important it was to connect agriculture as a business. So smallholder farmers, women, when particularly in Africa, it's a majority women, you know, how they need to be trained on business practices to better understand how they need linkages challenges to markets and how they have to engage with the private sector, whether those are small private sector seed companies or whether that's large multinational, and how all of those linkages, it's quite complex. It's why I love it intellectually, because it's not simple. It's very complicated to understand that entire chain from farm to fork, or some of the, you know, sound bites that we use in agricultural development, but how complex it all is and how interconnected it all is, and how you have to sort of build up those value chains all along different points, and how small things, well, it's not small things, big things like infrastructure can make such a difference in the lives of smallholders, because it is about feeder roads and about irrigation and all these other complicated systems so that we can grow the food that we need.
What got you, Kimberly, inspired or into this field? Why was it important for you when you started out?
Well, it's probably by accident, I'll be frank, of I never thought I would quite be at a think tank, or I never thought I'd be quite in agriculture. But I'll say it probably started as a Peace Corps volunteer. I did Peace Corps straight out of college, and I think that sort of started my love of understanding other cultures, my love of wanting to spend a life and a career focused on international something. And then it was when I started working for USAID, which originally was in the Caribbean before I spent time in Africa or other places, that I really started to understand the U.S. government's role in that and how foreign assistance programs can make such a big difference, or how they can be ineffective, like both sides, and really understanding that. My background is in strategic communications. Sure. So all along, I really enjoy the storytelling aspect, you know, how you can use images and how you can tell the story of both international development, but then it morphed into focusing really on agriculture. It was really when I started working within USAID on President Obama's Feed the Future, right when it started, that's when I started zeroing in my career and passion on food and agriculture. You know, in many developing countries, Ethiopia is a great example where I spent many years, 85% of the population depends on agriculture for a living. And you see that in many countries around the world, not just Africa, of agriculture is the backbone of the economy. And so you start to realize in development, not only is there that sort of humanitarian plight and pull and that meaning of trying to end hunger, but there's the economic side, there's the political will side. There's so many things that are sort of intertwined that once those start to layer upon layer, I just feel really grateful that I get to work in something that is meaningful in terms of trying to make lives better around the world, but also is complicated and complex in terms of policy or international development.
Pope Francis, since the very beginning of his pontificate, been very vocal on calling out against this globalization of indifference and asking people to put themselves in the shoes of the poor. Mm-hmm. He speaks often of people who are affected by climate change, people who are affected by lack of security, food security. Yeah. How do you view this stance, and has it had any effect on you or on the work you do?
You know, I think Pope Francis has such a broad audience. It's been interesting, you know, from the D.C. perspective to see how many people, especially when he came to visit D.C. this year, how many people are so energized by his presence. You know, people who aren't Catholic or who haven't thought a lot about the Pope or the Catholic Church, but there's something about him that he resonates with so many more people. So that means that his message is so much more important because he's able to reach people, whether it's about the fact that border are different than they were in the past, or whether it's about the compassion and need to kind of address hunger and poverty in the world. So for me, I mean, Pope Francis just adds another great voice to the work that I do and that others do, because he's going to reach people that I'm not going to reach. My bubble is fairly small in terms of policy and policymakers in Washington, D.C. who work on this, but he's able to reach so many more people. So the more young people he can energize of understanding about these topics and perhaps building a career and making, you know, and influencing directions, and this is the better. I just appreciate his voice on this.
That is fighting a globalization of indifference.
Yes.
People, so many young people seem to be so unaware of the predicament of people in other places of the world.
Yeah, so the more they can travel, whether that's through the programs that I've done, like Peace Corps, or many other programs out there, and whether that's just traveling to travel for your gap year, as other people call it here, but really trying to get out and see more and understand more about other cultures, the more that they can expand their worldview, the more that they can see usually how much they have taken for granted for what they have.
It also links back to what you were saying right at the beginning about the connection between food insecurity and conflict, and how it's a way to build peace as well.
Absolutely. As much much as food security can stabilize, is the opposite. Food insecurity can destabilize. So when you flip that around, I mean, of course, food insecurity relates to political instability and conflict, but the reverse is just as true, right? So when we can stabilize and we can make sure people are food secure, you know, that's going to create communities that are more resilient. That's going to create, you know, leadership as well that is more stable. And that's just as important to understand.
That was Kimberly Flowers speaking with Vatican Radio's Linda Bordoni.